Hello, it's Mark Knights talking about the British Enlightenment and scientific culture. And first of all, I wanted to stress the importance of thinking about the Enlightenment for the 18th century and thinking about its legacy, not only in terms of some of the themes that we've been exploring so far, but also in terms of some of the themes that we're going to be looking at later on in the term, particularly to do with gender and this week, the importance of it in terms of science. And to start off by thinking about whether the Enlightenment is a useful term when we're thinking about Britain in the 18th century, it obviously is a term used frequently by historians, but it papers over and covers over a lot of tensions within the 18th century and appears to give it a sort of coherence that is perhaps sometimes deceptive, and it tends to ignore some of the links between the 18th century and the 16th and 17th century. The Enlightenment, of course, was never a monolithic, uncontested set of ideas or processes, nor is it a single event. Rather, it is a series of debates and conversations which seeks to advance knowledge in certain areas, which I'll outline very briefly in a moment. Nor in the British context is it always revolutionary, as perhaps the association is with a French Enlightenment. Certainly in the first half of the 18th century, it seems entirely compatible with, perhaps even generated by, the revolution of 1689 and its aftermath. So in terms of its key strands, the Enlightenment was a process which stressed the importance of reason as against its buzzwords of prejudice and superstition and ignorance, and experiment, not just experiment in the scientific sense, but also experiment intellectually, pushing away at the boundaries of accepted or assumed knowledge and experimenting with ideas, all of which it was believed would lead to a progress towards the good life. So there's a culture of improvement, sometimes even a sort of utopian dimension to Enlightenment thinking about the perfectibility of man, the way in which life on earth as opposed to life after death might be improved, but the good life pushed away at in terms of material happiness, but also spiritual happiness. And it involves a reassessment of some major relationships, really, in the 18th century between man and God, for example. And we saw in earlier lectures the central role that religion continued to play in the 18th century. But some thinkers began to question in a quite aggressive and penetrating way many of the assumptions of Christianity about the nature of the Bible as the source of revealed religion, about the role of the clergy, which was often relabeled as priestcraft, a group of clerics who were intent on their own power rather than the piety of their flock, a questioning of core tenets of Calvinism and of a providential God that went along with that view, towards, in the eyes of Toland and others, a form of deism, the belief in a God but not necessarily a Christian God, a suspicion on the part of Hume of about miracles and the way in which the natural world in a sense limited the interventionist God of the 16th and 17th century. So major ways in which quite radical rethinking of accepted religious orthodoxies took place. That's not to say, of course, that the Enlightenment was incompatible with religion, and we'll see in a moment that figures like Joseph Priestley combine science and religion with remarkable ease. But nevertheless, there is an interesting strand of religious radicalism that goes beyond what we've looked at before. A reassessment, too, of relationships between peoples and rulers, a stress on liberty rather than slavery, a stress on citizenship rather than subjects, a stress on the role of the public rather than a world in which that public was excluded from participation in the state. So a stress on self-governance, a stress on a balanced constitution between sovereign monarch and the people, which in the British context seems to have been achieved at the revolution of 1689, but of course by the end of the 18th century the extent to which that is still a balanced constitution is deeply contested. What I want to talk about mostly, though, is the pursuit of knowledge about the natural world and advances in science and in ways of thinking about the natural world, the body, the universe, and so on. Just before we do that, I want just to pause and say, how far is this a British Enlightenment? Because when we think of the Enlightenment, we think of a European movement, and of course scholars in Britain are deeply influenced by their continental thinkers. But there is an argument to say that Britain is actually precocious in some of its thinking, and characters like Voltaire in his Lettre Philosophique of 1733 certainly look to Britain for inspiration about what might be achieved, and an idealization of certainly the scientific advances in Britain, but also the post-revolutionary political structures that had been created. But alongside that sort of English strand, we might also want to suggest that there is an important Scottish Enlightenment. So this is truly a British Enlightenment rather than an English Enlightenment, and we think of Edinburgh as an important centre of Enlightenment thought in the mid and later 18th century. In part, the scientific and advancement of learning is a reflection of a larger trend within the Enlightenment, which is that stress on sociability, the good life, incorporating and indeed flowing from sociable interaction. And this is an era when clubs and societies really take off in very large numbers, and many of these are interestingly scientific societies. And one case study of this is the Lunar Society in Birmingham, so-called because it met every month on the Sunday nearest the full moon, so that participants could make use of the light to travel to the meetings, but also continued through correspondence and through individual meetings of its members. And a quite extraordinary array of people involved: Joseph Priestley, Josiah Wedgwood, Erasmus Darwin, Matthew Bolton, James Watt, and others. And the Lunar Society is a good example of how this Enlightenment is both provincial — this is taking place outside of London, of course — and is also deeply practical. Many of the advances of learning that are pushed during meetings are applied to improve both the lives of individual members of the group, but also their manufacturing processes. And there is a very practical element to this Enlightenment. So Erasmus Darwin, for example, a physician, fed up of travelling on bumpy roads, designs carriages to take him on his medical rounds in a smoother manner. There is a direct applicability between their common interest in properties of the airs and gas and water with the development of the steam engine and the developments that Josiah Wedgwood introduces in his manufacturing of pottery. So there's a very practical element to this. Many of the characters are also religiously unorthodox. Erasmus Darwin, a deist. Joseph Priestley, a dissenting minister with Unitarian, that's to say anti-Trinitarian, views. Many of them are also deeply involved in politics. Priestley, a political radical involved in anti-slavery, and his house was famously burnt during a riot in 1791 against radical ideas. Josiah Wedgwood, also involved in the abolition of the slave trade, pro-American in his views. There is an interesting way in which the different strands that we've been looking at of the Enlightenment, whether it's politics, religion, economics and science, are fused together in this group. One other way in which the Enlightenment had a very practical purchase on 18th century life was in the improvements in medicine and in public science. And there are a large number of hospitals founded in the 18th century, in part a reflection of the sort of philanthropic thrust of many and utopian thrust of many of the Enlightenment thinkers, also that a reflection of that very sort of practical improvement and progress, and also a concern to improve the lot of mankind. And we can see some of that reflected in the development of medical practices, the development of self-help medical books, giving the public much greater access to medical knowledge than before. And so print culture, which we've looked at in previous lectures, also plays an important part in the dissemination and discussion of scientific ideas. And science in this period is a very public affair. It's carried out as part of the polite and sociable culture that was developing in the 18th century, not just in London, but again throughout the provinces. Most towns by the early 19th century had travelling lecturers, had clubs which were interested in the new science and were actively engaged in consuming it in the way that we've been looking at a consumer culture developing. And public science, important in a sense, because the public then become the verifiers of the scientific experiments, therefore there is an interactive process. So what I've been trying to stress in this lecture really is the nature of a British Enlightenment, one which finds inspiration from the events and the culture of the late 17th and early 18th century, which then develops, particularly in Scotland, in the mid-18th century, and how this scientific knowledge, through the sort of club mentality, becomes disseminated, but also applied in very practical situations, as we see with the case study of the Lunar Society.